Welcome to Studio 2 on a Tuesday. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. Cherry?
Yes.
I'm calling it.
Call it.
April 9th.
Mm-hmm.
This is the day you can safely put your winter jacket in storage. I've looked at the long-term forecast.
Okay.
I'm looking at highs in the 60s and 70s consistently out into late April. And then at that point, I think the seasons just take us home. Put the parka away.
I have jazz hands right now for those who can't see me. The peep toe shoes are coming out. I can't wait.
We also can't wait for today's show.
Mm-hmm.
A lot coming. We have an interview this segment with a Washington Post reporter talking about these potentially huge changes coming to the student loan landscape. We're going to get you up to speed there. Ask some of your how-to questions.
Could we get relief?
And will it stand?
Mm-hmm.
Middle segment today, this is pretty exciting. We're talking with world-renowned soprano Renee Fleming.
Yes.
She's not coming on the show to sing. She's not coming on this show even to talk about her performance, although perhaps we'll get there a little bit. She's coming on to talk about the connection between music and health.
Yeah.
A topic that she's become quite fascinated with over the years. And in fact, she has collaborated with the NIH on creating more robust research around this idea that music can be used as medicine to heal us. So Renee Fleming, that's the middle segment today. And then the third segment, all about
pasta.
Pasta. one of my favorite foods.
Mm-hmm.
It's delicious. I didn't know how wrong I was about pasta until I read some of the work of Dan Pashman, who is a pasta shape inventor, a pasta hot take artist.
Yeah, a lot of hot takes from Dan over there.
Dan is not shy. Also wrote a cookbook called Anything's Possible.
Mm-hmm.
81 pasta recipes in this cookbook, and we're just going to pepper him.
Yeah.
With questions about pasta, kind of like the server that comes to the table and grates the pepper onto the pasta.
Mm-hmm.
That's us today. We're peppering Pashman with pasta questions.
Yeah. And I mean, and you got to be a pasta person if you're going to invent your own pasta. And it's
pretty cool
looking. So we're going to talk to him about that. I have tons of questions for him because I want to get invited to the cookout. So I'm going to get a good recipe to take with me. And if you have questions for Renee Fleming about art and healing or about pasta, if you have those for Dan, you can call us 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org.
Quick question.
Mm-hmm.
What do you mean you want to get invited to the cookout? What does that mean?
I want to make a good recipe that I can take to these cookouts that are going to start because you just called it. Parkas are up.
Got it.
Cookout's
about
to start. I want to be ready.
Got it. No, totally. Totally. I'm with you.
There it is.
Are we ready for some news now?
We are.
Okay, let's get into it.
So Mayor Parker announced Michael Resnick, the former public safety director, will now be her commissioner for the Department of Prisons. Now, this announcement came Monday, the very same day that civil rights groups filed a motion asking a federal judge to fine the city for constitutional violations within Philadelphia prisons. Now, first things first, who is this Resnick guy? He's an attorney. He's a former longtime public servant here working in the city of Philadelphia. He briefly served as acting prisons commissioner back in 2015. He would replace Blanche Carney, who announced her retirement from that commissioner position last month. Her last day was Friday. What he will inherit, let me just tell you, he will inherit several high-profile escapes, three homicides over the last 6 months, and a years-long staffing crisis. This brings me to the other part of what happened on Monday. The motion filed in federal court. It's all a part of this class action that was filed during the pandemic. A judge had appointed a monitor to oversee the jails. Oversight was supposed to end last year, but it was extended to 2026 because of this staffing crisis, because of all that was going on. Now, these civil rights groups, they want a judge to fine the city about $23,000 a day until they're able to hire more correction officers and they're able to ensure that people can spend more than an hour outside of their jail cell. So a lot is going on. You got a new commissioner. You got this lawsuit.
I've said this before when reacting to appointments by Mayor Parker. it seems like almost everyone who gets appointed to a high-profile post has some history here in the city of Philadelphia as a bureaucrat. You mentioned Resnick briefly served as acting prisons commissioner in 2015 and has been around in other capacities. That seems to be the Parker playbook. People who have been in Philly, who know Philly.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, she has her own very, very deep roots here, not just as a person, but as a politician. So I think this fits the pattern.
Yeah, and they say she did a national search, but
they
again,
sure did.
Landed on this guy, Resnick. So
a lot of national searches, a lot of Philly people picked. Mm-hmm. For better or for worse, that's not a judgment. I just think that's the pattern that we have seen so clearly in her picks to this point.
And we could hear from him pretty soon because there's going to be city council hearings about the situation in the prison. So he'll be front and center, I'm pretty sure.
Let's zoom out
to
the state of Pennsylvania. Today is the last day that counties can send out your mail-in ballots for the upcoming primary. Most counties have already gotten that rolling. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't gotten your mail-in ballot yet, you should get it soon. And you will notice some changes. There's color coding this year to try to highlight areas that you're supposed to fill out. For instance, don't forget to fill out the date of completion, not your birth date, the date of completion in the 2022 election.
Yes.
10,000 voters put the wrong date on their ballot, and an appeals court recently held that those votes do not count. So freshly color-coded mail-in ballots on their way out or perhaps have already arrived. Yes, it is election season here in Pennsylvania.
Yes, April 23rd. Mm-hmm. I know that the presidential primary already decided it's going to be Trump versus Biden yet again. But we have quite a few statewide races.
AG.
And local races on the ballot. Yes, yeah, state attorneys general, attorney general. We have a number of people running for that position. Also, local congressional seats, Senate. Like, there's a lot of things that people need to pay attention to. So make sure, you know, if you want a mail-in ballot, you have until, I believe, the 16th to apply. So make sure you do that. The last day to change, you know, your address or anything already passed. That was on Monday. So
you're such a lawyer.
I know.
Saying attorneys general, by the way,
which
is correct.
I know.
That is the correct plural. But it sounds so weird.
I know.
But look, you got it right. It is attorneys general.
You know I care about that kind of stuff. So, but yeah, and staying in Pennsylvania, by the way, for the very first time, Avi, the Commonwealth has million-dollar neighborhoods. Can we say
what's that?
Cha-ching. Okay.
Million-dollar neighborhood.
So, yeah.
Well, sounds pricey.
Yeah, it is. It's very expensive.
Okay.
$1 million at least just to get in. You know, we've already always had, you know, homes that are in, you know, over $1 million. But we haven't until very recently had neighborhoods where the average price was for all the homes was like $1 million.
Average. The median.
Yeah, the median price
wow.
was like $1 million. And according to Zillow, we now have $2 million neighborhoods, Gladwin in Montgomery County and Villanova, which is in both Montgomery and Delaware counties. How did this happen? Well, there's an extremely tight, you know, real estate market, and this has led to high demand and has caused the price and value of homes to shoot up.
Mm.
From this year to last year, if you own a home, average value went up 4%, according to Zillow. So that's how, you know, these neighborhoods have kind of boosted in now to million-dollar neighborhoods.
So Gladwin?
Yeah.
And Villanova?
Mm-hmm.
Million-dollar neighborhoods.
Yeah.
Well, I'll give
I want to drive through now. I'm going to go look around, see what's going on over there.
That's nice.
Yeah.
I will point out that there could be another cause here. You mentioned the tight housing market.
Yeah.
I mean, I went to college on the Main Line right near these two neighborhoods. So perhaps somehow people want to be close to my past, and that is driving home prices skyward. I mean, correlation, causation, it's hard to say, Jerry, but I'll give Zillow a call.
Yeah.
Just put that theory before them and see what they think.
See what they think. That's a good one. And by the way, nationally, million-dollar communities, we only have 491 million-dollar communities a year ago in the country. Now it's 550.
And I'll say famed humorist Dave Barry also went to my college. So maybe people want to be close to his past as well. I mean, he's very funny.
I love it.
All right. More money talk now.
Mm-hmm.
Vice President Kamala Harris was in Philadelphia yesterday unveiling the administration's new student debt relief plan. President Biden did the same in Wisconsin. another swing state. The new proposal could impact 30 million borrowers. That's a lot of people.
Yeah, and this new effort could start this fall if it stands up to legal challenges. You may remember last year, Biden tried to wipe out most student debt, but that plan was blocked by the U.S. Supreme Court. Here to fill us in on all the important details of this latest proposal is Danielle Douglas-Gabriel, who covers the economics of higher education for The Washington Post. Danielle, welcome back to Studio 2.
Thanks for having me.
We're so glad to have you because there's a lot to explain here, Danielle, and I'll start with this. Who would be eligible if this proposal, in fact, makes it to the finish line?
So the vast majority of people with federal loans will benefit from some component of this, and there are five components of this plan. So they're really trying to cover their bases here. People who, I think there are like 40 million people who have student loans, so hitting 30 million out of that 40 million is pretty impressive.
And so it sounds really good. I mean, I felt like I fall into one of those categories, the people who've been paying at least 20 years, right? And hearing some of this, should we hold our breath? I mean, because what is the likelihood that this will actually happen given the legal snafus that Biden ran into the last time?
So there's no doubt there'll be some legal challenges to this. However, this law, this particular plan stands on firmer legal footing than the last one because the administration is using a Higher Education Act to do this. And that act allows for all the existing forgiveness programs that we already know, like the ones for public servants, the ones for folks who are totally and permanently disabled. So they're really just building out the existing framework that is there. But since that framework doesn't cover everybody, this plan tries to reach and be a little bit more expansive to make sure that folks who don't get covered by public service loan forgiveness or any of those other plans will still get some help.
Is there a subset of borrowers who would benefit the most? Because you said it's a big universe of borrowers here, but when we look at this plan, is there one group that stands to really, really benefit?
So if we look by the numbers in terms of how many people are really affected, like 25 million people could see the interest on their student loans reduce pretty significantly. We're talking up to $20,000 accrued interest. And those are pretty significant numbers. But when you think about the size of debt that could be forgiven, people, as like you mentioned, who have been paying for more than 20 or 25 years could have the balance of their loans completely forgiven automatically. And I think that's the important part, too. The last plan required an application. This time around, the administration is saying, I think we can do all of this automatically without you having to fill out anything.
So I don't, it's just going to happen. It's just going to show up. I don't have to do, this indeed goes through, me, the borrower, I don't have to lift a single finger.
Yeah, that's the plan. And this is a little different because this process went through what's known as negotiated rulemaking. Mm-hmm. And there's a calendar and a schedule for that. So the vast majority of the rule will go through in July of next year. But that interest piece that we discussed could happen as soon as this fall because the department already has the authority to do it. They just need to finalize this plan, which they said they can do in the coming months.
Wow. So everything, Danielle, is about politics. Any ideas on how or whether voters, specifically minority and young voters, how are they responding to this latest attempt to fulfill this years-old campaign promise? What are you hearing?
I mean, it may be too soon to say whether or not this will be enough to energize that part of the coalition, of Biden's coalition. But certainly borrowers that I've spoken to, they're excited by the fact that the president isn't giving up on that campaign promise. Certainly after the Supreme Court's decision, he could have stopped, but he continued to forge ahead with an alternative plan, which is what this is. And so I think people like the idea that at least he's still committed to this. Certainly there are a lot of borrowers who are saying this isn't enough. You know, $20,000 in interest, that is nothing when I owe $60,000 or $70,000 in federal student loans. But there is still excitement there about the fact that this is continuing on.
And you said the two key words, this fall, in terms of maybe part of this proposal being enacted then, and we know what's happening this fall. That is Danielle Douglas-Gabriel, who covers the economics of higher education for The Washington Post. Thanks again for your time.
Thank you.
So, coming up, we will talk to the world-renowned soprano Renee Fleming about the healing power of music. Have you had a musical experience that you just love?
so many.
Yeah.
But we only have 30 seconds until break, Cherry, so I'm going to give people the phone number, 888-477-9499, if you want to give us a call. Studio2@WHYY.org. That's the email. Join us. To earn as much as they can possibly, then turn around and spend it foolishly. We created us a credit card mess. We spend the money that we don't possess. Our religion is to go and blow it all. So it's shopping every Sunday at the mall.
So beautiful. I'm Cherry Gregg, and that, of course, is the great soprano Renee Fleming singing Puccini's aria Un Bel Dì.
And welcome back. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt. Even those of us who know nothing about opera have heard Renee Fleming's voice. She is one of the world's most celebrated opera stars, winning 5 Grammys, a U.S. National Medal of Arts, performing in movies and presidential inaugurations. But offstage, she's been lending her voice to a very different project, drawing attention to the connection between music and our health.
Fleming has been spearheading a National Institutes of Health and National Endowment of the Arts collaboration, investigating the effect of music and all the creative arts on our brains and our bodies. Scientists have found that therapies using the arts can help with depression, Parkinson's, MS, and in her own case, pain. Renee Fleming joins us now to talk about what we are learning and how music affects our brain, all of which she writes about in her brand new anthology, Music and Mind, Harnessing the Arts for Health and Wellness. Renee Fleming, welcome to Studio 2.
Thank you, Cherry and Avi. It's great to be with you.
We're so glad to have you. And we invite the listeners to join us if you have questions for Renee Fleming about art and healing. Give us a call. 888-477-9499. You can also email us, studio2@whyy.org.
And Renee, I wanted to start our conversation because you have performed on stages around the world, and now you've sort of transitioned from performance to helping the public and science better understand the link between music and the art and the mind. Not a bad next act, by the way, but it began at a dinner party. Tell us about that day.
Well, I'm doing both at the same time now, which is it's a lot. I'm loving it. And the dinner party was really interesting because it was the week of the Marriage Equality Act decision, and there happened to be 3 justices at this dinner, and they weren't necessarily friendly, shall we say, in that moment. Even though RBG and Scalia were very close friends. And Anthony Kennedy was there as well. So Francis Collins, Dr. Collins, who was then head of the National Institutes of Health, brought his guitar, and we started chatting about why scientists were studying music and the brain. So we also started singing together, and everybody calmed down and had a wonderful evening, and we started a project, you know, bringing together the NIH or the Kennedy Center and the NEA. And it's been going strong ever since. In fact, it's growing like crazy.
Very productive dinner party. I wish mine were that productive. But I want to read in a couple of comments here, Renee. Matt says, as a teenager, I think music helped form my identity. It was the glue that attracted me to my tribe. Marie says, music has been my therapist for a long time. Often songwriters and artists are able to deliver the unintelligibles of life. We have so much anecdotal evidence about the way music affects us emotionally, our mood, and yet translating that into the scientific realm takes a lot of work. So what do scientists know for sure? And what are some of the things that they're looking into?
Well, the thing that's changed is technology. So now we can really look at the brain. I myself have participated in an fMRI study at the NIH. And people are doing all kinds of studies like this. So what we know, of course, is that for this type of thing, mental health and anxiety, which we're going to have a lot of this year, and depression, all of these things, really, music helps tremendously. Even listening to music, just it raises the endorphin level in the brain, the chemicals, et cetera. So these things can be measured now, but especially with music. And there's the larger umbrella of arts, and this NeuroArts Blueprint that I'm also involved in includes in experiences in nature and the visual arts, and all of these aesthetic experiences.
Wow. Renee, you've actually had a chance to look at the scans of your brain that were taken while you were singing. Sounds fascinating. What was that process like, and what did you learn from that experience?
Well, I'm singing, speaking, and imagining singing. And what surprised everybody is that in my brain, at least, imagining singing was the most powerful. It impacted more parts of the brain than the other two. And you know, it's interesting because one of the reasons music is powerful is because it's in every known mapped part of the brain. So it is so complex. Our engagement with music, especially really touches on almost every aspect of being human. And that's why it's really powerful.
We are.
But I learned, frankly, the fact that I was imagining singing, they assumed that because I'm a singer, that perhaps took a little more effort in the MRI machine, which was so loud, than really just singing, which for me is second nature at this point.
Wow.
We are speaking with Renee Fleming about art and healing. You can email us, studio2@whyy.org. Here's a comment from Cletus who says, I believe music and singing helped my mom recover from my father's death. And she joined me singing in my band, which has been important for my own mental health.
Wow.
I was reading,
Fabulous.
yeah, and it's such a great story, Cletus, and it made me think about an insight that was in the anthology about how singing with a group can actually
Yes.
potentially be more powerful than even singing alone or listening to music alone. What are we learning about sort of the benefits of the collaborative nature of music?
Well, there are wonderful studies on singing now. Really, they're kind of coming fast, and one of the ones I love the most is that it's used, singing is being used in a choir to treat postpartum depression, and the World Health Organization is actually expanding this and really bringing it to other countries in Europe. But I mean, I wouldn't have guessed that one. And of course, for stroke, for anybody who's had a stroke, if they can sing in a choir, they're going to improve. You have the social connection, which is so important. And our brain waves align when we're having a shared musical experience. It also lifts your immune response.
Wow, I sang in a choir when I was in college, and I would have like an emotional response at every single performance. It was a beautiful, beautiful time. I want to read Frederica's comment. She says, I've always said the music is a sound massage, but I'm wondering if Miss Fleming has looked at what reverb and musical distortion does to our bodies. Have you looked at this issue, Renee?
Well, reverb really is vibration, and vibration can be incredibly healthy. I mean, we're using now so many, we're looking at vibration in terms of Alzheimer's disease. MIT is working on a study now that uses 40 hertz to clean up amyloid plaques in the brain. And they're just remarkable. You know, they're using, Nina Kraus is using it for concussion. For instance, she can test the level of the concussion by using hearing testing. So, and also, I frankly think that the wonderful studies that are happening now that are using vibration, actually, they're gonna start breaking apart cancer cells in the next 5 years.
That's
So.
what's, yeah, and that's what's so fascinating to me because implicitly I thought, well, yes, there could be benefits for mental health, treating depression. Obviously, music creates a sort of a mood attachment in every human being. But then when you get into some of these more physical seeming therapies that could be linked to music, people who have Parkinson's, people who have Alzheimer's, that it triggers some sort of physical response that could be palliative. I mean, how close are we to really proving that stuff, Renee, or is it sort of speculative at this point?
Well, pain is already, there's tremendous research around pain that's really working. Parkinson's absolutely and other movement disorders because the plasticity of the brain allows for for this freezing and shuffling to be bypassed, and people can even be quite graceful, which is remarkable. So rhythm is incredibly powerful as well. But these are the other pillar of is this. It's a technique that I really love called intonation, melodic intonation therapy. So for instance, somebody who has aphasia, who can't speak, you can bypass the speech part of the brain and go right to the singing part. And in one, sometimes in one intervention with a music therapist, you can regain speech. So that's something people really need to know about. I don't think it's widely understood or known, frankly.
Wow. And if you are
A lot
just,
of,
oh, go ahead.
sorry.
I
No, I was
apologize.
just going to say a lot of what we need to do at this point is dissemination, is really sharing the information with the public.
Yeah. And that's what we're doing today. If you are just tuning in, we're speaking with Renee Fleming, acclaimed soprano and the editor of a new anthology of writing on the power of the creative arts and health. It's called Music and Mind. If you have questions for Renee, give us a call, 888-477-9499. You can also email studio2@whyy.org. One of the things that stuck with me, Renee, about your story is this tension between your talent and love of singing and the stage fright and anxiety. You spent years trying to deal with this. Describe your experience and what it took to work your way through it. And in many ways, music is involved.
Well, I mean, it was my, obviously my job. And so anytime your job is threatened because you feel like you can't go on stage, and there are some people, some famous people, Barbra Streisand among them, who leave the stage for sometimes decades. So I didn't want to do that, and I had really great support. So I needed to understand where it was coming from, and I needed a lot of behavioral therapy to stop seeing the audience as so judgmental. I imagine the audience holding up scorecards every time I walked on
Oh,
stage.
gosh.
And instead, I had to sort of imagine that I was sharing something beautiful with the audience. And now I really love performing. I had to change my thinking about it.
And you've actually performed certain songs and entered a meditative state, sort of while on stage. Can you talk about that experience as well? Because a lot of people use, well, music to help meditate and to clear their mind.
Absolutely. I mean, for me, it's I enter a flow state and I'm in the zone when I'm performing, especially things that are sustained, like the four last songs that I'm doing this week, and here in Atlanta. And I love that. I never get tired of it. And the other state that we can enter into that's so healthy is awe. It's when something really touches us and moves us. So whether it's, the Grand Canyon or listening to a brilliant piece of music, that's incredibly good for our health to feel that.
I want to read in one more comment here from Andrea, who says, "Music stopped me from wearing an orange jumpsuit." Wow.
Oh
That's pretty
dear,
powerful.
that's phenomenal. That is really powerful. Oh, I want to read her book.
Absolutely. I want to. I have a really young daughter, and she's just turned one. And when you have a little kid, one of the things that you notice is sort of like what's elemental? What are the sort of the things that are sort of baked into the human brain that express themselves really, really early? And for her, music was absolutely one of them. She had a consistent sort of dancey response to music at a really young age. And then you start asking these big questions, Renee, like why? Why do we seem to have this music gene in us? And there was an essay in the book by Robert Zatorre, I hope I'm pronouncing his name right, talking
Yes.
about sort of like why music evolved and debates around music. And there's another essay in there at the very beginning also about sort of musical evolution in the brain and what's going on in our reward circuitry. How do you explain to people
Right. Well, I need to
why
tell you.
music seems to exist universally in the human brain? What's your explanation?
When I started on this path, I didn't know anything and I really had no idea. And it was evolution that really helped me understand because I didn't, I was indoctrinated too. I thought that music was entertainment. I thought the arts were entertainment. And now I really see them as needing to be embedded in healthcare. But in fact, I think it's pretty well sh been shown to predate speech in us. I just came back from India. I was on vacation there and had a fascinating experience and learned, for instance, that there are monks who sing in a language that linguists tried to unpack, and they discovered that it predated speech and probably related to animal sounds. And they're still singing these songs. So it tells you that it's been with us since really the beginning of mankind.
And when you think about this, I mean, we kind of know that music is healing. We know that it connects us. So why do you think it's taken so long for the medical community to sort of recognize this, connect it, and not just as a, a therapy that you use if you can't find any other, treatment, but why haven't they embraced it and may make it a part of the prescription that we give folks?
Well, it's interesting because in other countries and in the global south, even, they never stopped using music as a healing modality. I know Zakir Hussain, who's from India, and he said that it's always been kind of both a religious experience to participate in music, but also for sure healing. And of course, the US has a very high bar for efficacy. They require double-blind studies and a level of research, and it's got to be very rigorous. So we're only just now able to do that, as I said, because of technology. So we're getting there. We're getting there. It's baby steps, but it doesn't mean that there isn't a tremendous amount of research that helps people embed it into society now, whether it's choirs or dancing or, gosh, there's an amazing researcher who uses singing to improve cardiovascular health, because for sedentary people, singing is exercise. So I mean, every day I'm thinking, this is incredible what's happening right now. So, and they're also states are beginning to license everywhere in the country so that we can eventually get this covered by insurance. And we have global prescriptions as well. We have these wonderful social prescribing in several states where if you go to a doctor, they're just as likely to say, hey, you need to go to the park. You need to go to a concert. This is what I want you to do. This is a wonderful health prescribing that's beyond pills.
Beyond Pills, non-pharmaceutical. We will see where this goes. Thank you so much. That's Renee Fleming. Her new anthology is Music and Mind, Harnessing the Arts for Health and Wellness. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Cherry and Abby. Great talking to you.
And we're going to close with the singing of Renee Fleming. This is O Mio Bambino Caro from Puccini. Renee Fleming taking us into our next segment, Cherry, which is all about pasta. So there's sort of an opera to pasta
I love
connection, I
that. I
think.
love that.
And so that is coming up on Studio Two, closing again with Renee Fleming. Welcome back to Studio 2. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt.
And I'm Cherry Gregg. Look, Avi, spaghetti stinks. It's bad. It's not a good type of pasta. Everything slips off it. And when you finish your plate, there's just a big pool of wasted soft left right there at the bottom, right? Now, none of this is my opinion because I want to put some space so I won't get the hate emails. But this is the opinion of our next guest, Dan Pashman.
Dan has opinions about pasta, lots of opinions, so many that he wrote an entire cookbook filled with them. It's called Anything's Pastable, 81 Inventive Recipes for Saucy People. Dan Pashman also hosts The Sporkful, an award-winning food podcast, and he is perhaps now best known for inventing a new type of pasta called cascatelli. So if you like pasta, if you like food takes hotter than a heavily salted pot of boiling water, this is the segment for you. Dan Pashman, welcome to Studio 2.
Thanks, both of you, for having me.
Yes, and of course, listeners, you can email us with your own pasta preferences or questions at studio2@whyy.org. Our number is 888-477-9499.
Dan, You're going to offer us a lot of wisdom and opinions in this segment. But first, we need to ask you why we should pay attention to your pasta opinions. What are your credentials, sir?
Yeah, lay them out, man.
Well, my wife asked the same question when I set out on the process of writing this cookbook. But look, I've been hosting this Borkful podcast for a long time. And a few years back, I set out on this mission to invent a new shape of pasta because, as you said, Cherry, in your intro, I was dissatisfied with a lot of the shapes out there. So I invented this new shape called cascatelli that was specially designed to hold tons of sauce, to have a variety of different textures, to be especially satisfying and interesting to bite into. And it exceeded my wildest expectations. It's now in stores across the country. The original version is made by an artisanal company in upstate New York called Sfolini. And there's other versions out there. And so it went viral. It was named one of Time Magazine's Best Inventions of the Year, which was all incredible. But the issue that I ran into was that everyone sent me pictures of what they were making with cascatelli, which is that part was exciting. But the part that upset me a little bit was that over and over again, it was the same couple of dishes. Tomato sauce, meat sauce, mac and cheese. I mean, a couple of wild and crazy folks might have made pesto.
Ooh.
But it just, I like all those sauces, nothing wrong with them, but it's just like, it just showed me how limited the range of pasta sauces is for most folks out there. And even I myself am guilty sometimes of just falling into that red sauce rut. And so I decided, what if I were to make a cookbook that were to show people that there's so much more they can and should be putting on pasta?
All right, Dan. We buy your story.
All right.
Okay, we're convinced.
All right, Dan.
You could just be the guy.
Dan the pasta man. We got it. We're in.
So right, let's just lay some ground rules, Dan. What are the rules of a really good pasta? And give us an example or two.
You're talking about a really good pasta sauce?
Shape. Yeah. We're going to start with the shape of the pasta itself.
Right. So I have three criteria that I use to judge all pasta shapes. So there's forkability, which is how easy is it to get it on your fork and keep it there. Sauceability, how well does sauce adhere to the shape. And tooth sinkability, which is how satisfying is it to really sink your teeth into it. Mm. I think a lot of shapes nail, get one or two of these things right. Very few nail all three. As you said, Cherry, I don't think spaghetti really even gets one. Try to get a good bite of spaghetti on the fork. It's always either too big or too small. Then you finish the pasta and the sauce is left on the plate. But a couple of, obviously I'm biased. The cascatelli shape that I invented, I think, does all three. But there's other really great ones out there. I love one called Casareche, which is sort of like a matchstick, like size and shape, but twisted. And so it has all kinds of nooks and crannies in it. I love Mafalda, which inspired cascatelli. That's like fettuccine, but with ruffles down the edges. Mm. I think that one thing I learned in all of my research for cascatelli is that people think that tubes are the only way to hold a lot of sauce. But in fact, tubes are not great for holding sauce. Rigatoni, which I like. Rigatoni, I think, is a very good basic shape. But it goes flat when you cook it. It's not much. The tube kind of isn't there anymore. A bucatini is a very narrow tube, so narrow that not much sauce gets inside. You have penne and ziti are your medium-sized tubes, but even those being medium-sized diameter tubes, the slightest chunk in sauce is not going to get inside those tubes. So I actually favor shapes with ruffles, ridges, twists, turns, nooks, and crannies. I find that those shapes hold sauce much better than tubes do.
A lot of the recipes in this book are fusion-y. They take some elements of another type of cuisine that isn't typically associated with pasta, and they integrate it into a pasta dish. And one that really caught my attention, because it has a Philly connection, is kimchi carbonara. Tell us about this recipe, and if you could also, there's a chef who was in Philly who helped inspire it. So, paint the Philly picture for us as well.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, so just first off, there are no traditional classic pasta recipes in this cookbook. I'm not against
one.
Those. Not one.
No Alfredo. No string carbonara.
Right. No marinara. No lasagna bolognese. I'm not against any of those. I just
but go to another cookbook for those. Yeah.
Right. The world doesn't need another recipe for those cookbooks. The world doesn't need another cookbook with those recipes in them. They're already out there. Mm-hmm. So yes, there's a recipe in here for kimchi carbonara, which I collaborated with the chef and recipe developer Irene Yu on that one. And she grew up in the West Coast. She's Korean American. She grew up eating mostly Korean food, but she was telling me how she moved to Philly for college, and then as we know, across the northeastern part of the U.S., you have a large Italian-American population. She started getting more into Italian food and going out to these sort of red sauce joints in Philly and having carbonara. And that blew her mind. She became obsessed with carbonara. and cooked it over and over again at home until she felt like she had mastered it. And she got very into Italian food, but then found herself kind of craving some of the flavors from home, the Korean flavors, and that was what inspired her to mash these things up and to take the raw beaten eggs, the guanciale, the cured pork, the black pepper, the cheese, and add in sauteed kimchi, which is phenomenal. And
so
and folks, people who eat a lot of kimchi already know this, but when you saute kimchi in a pan, it really changes it. It's very different from raw kimchi. It softens it. It mellows out the spice and the flavor and the funk a little bit without eliminating it. And when you get a little bit of the crunch and the acidity and the tang and the spice from that kimchi, cutting through the creamy richness of the egg of the carbonara, and you get the salty smokiness of the pork and the black pepper, it is just such a good combination.
Yeah, I'm getting a green check mark on that.
Dan can draw a picture and put flavors in your mouth. Go ahead, Dan. So you are this bona fide pasta expert, and we talked about the actual pasta itself, but you make the argument that you don't need to make a pasta sauce from scratch, and you actually have a whole chart that has a decision tree on it on how you can like punch up some sauce. So give us the rundown on how to make, take a sauce that's already made and like make it better.
Absolutely. Yeah. Early on in the process of working on this cookbook, I tested a recipe for a sirloin ragu, basically like an upscale tomato-based meat sauce. And it was very good, but it took me about 2 hours to make it. And it was only a little bit better than the most basic meat sauce you can throw together in 10 minutes. And I made a declaration to myself in that moment. I decided not to put that recipe in the cookbook. And I said, if I'm going to put any tomato-based, because I've just eaten so much tomato sauce with pasta, if I'm going to put any tomato-based sauces in this cookbook, they have to either be truly different from anything I've had before or ridiculously easy. And for the ridiculously easy part, I say just buy jarred sauce. There are so many fantastic, high-quality jarred tomato sauces on the market today. Find the one that you like. And by that, you don't need to make tomato sauce from scratch. And so I have this thing in the book called the Jarred Tomato Sauce Decision Tree.
Mm-hmm.
You start off with a jar of great sauce. And then it gives you a bunch of different ways to doctor that jar of sauce. Do you want to make it heartier? Do you want to make it creamier? Do you want to make it spicier? You know, more savory? Do you want to add texture? You answer the questions in this tree. You follow the prompts, and it's like a choose your own adventure with a jar of sauce. And it ends up with about 15 different recipes for what you can do starting with a jar of sauce. Some of the techniques are as simple as add a scoop of this or that. Some of them are a little more involved, depending on what you have time for and what you're looking for, but it will allow you to really take that jar of sauce and in a relatively short amount of time, transform it into something new and exciting.
Quick follow-up question to you, because you say anything is pasta-able. So
yes.
Can I take any kind of sauce? Like, for example, like a butter sauce that has an Indian flavor and like beef that up? Like, does this tree work? Like a creamy butter sauce that has the Indian curry flavors in it.
Huh.
Can I take that, beef it up, and pastify it? That's a good word.
Yeah.
Yes, can I pastify that? Does that same decision tree, in other words, is it applicable to other types of sauces?
Well, the decision tree itself is designed to start with a jar of tomato sauce. That being said, there is kind of, I think, Cherry, kind of what you're saying in the opposite. One of the options, if you follow it down, is to add Indian inspiration to that jar of sauce by adding some masala, and then you add a little bit of cream and peas, and you could do paneer if you have it on hand. There's a lot of options. But then there's also, like, if you want to get back into the other recipes for the cookbook, if you love Indian flavors, we have a vodka sauce with tomato achar. It's as simple as vodka sauce, except you just open up a jar of tomato achar, an Indian sort of pickle relish, and it infuses the entire dish with Indian spices. There's also a recipe for a keema bolognese. It mashes up the classic Indian ground meat dish of keema with bolognese, and that one is one of the absolute highlights of the
Sounds
book.
Delicious.
I think the theme that I get from all of this is that people do not treat pasta as the truly versatile food that it is.
Mm.
However, Jaden might have taken it too far. Jaden wants to know what Dan thinks about ketchup on spaghetti.
Look, Avi, I'm not going to yuck someone's yum, okay? if that makes you happy...
Go for it.
Then, I'm not going to judge you, but yes, I think that, there's a lot of things...
You could,
right.
though.
No, it's not for him. Don't
do it. Don't do it, yeah.
Right. No, but you're right in general, Avi, that like I think that people have a narrow idea of, you know, I think that people are almost a little bit scared of messing with Italian food.
Yes.
There's this sort of stereotype of Italians as being kind of very upset when anybody sort of messes with their tradition. But one of the really interesting things I learned working on this cookbook, I did a research trip across Italy, which I write about in the book and which I covered in the Sporkful podcast. And the big, my most shocking takeaway from that trip was, you know, I talked to an Italian food historian named Luca Cesari. I talked with Katie Parla, who's a cookbook author in Rome. Pasta only became the national food of Italy about 100 years ago. Mm. It was thanks to an effort by the fascist government at the time that wanted to unite the country under a nationalist identity. They decided pasta was the key. They started building pasta factories in parts of Italy where there were none before. There's a whole archive of fascist propaganda of like this idea that pasta is the true Italian food. Mm. But it's actually relatively new. And I mean, in terms of it being all across Italy and iconic pasta dishes like carbonara, I would have guessed that the Roman emperors must have been eating carbonara.
Right, right.
But in fact, carbonara was only invented in the 1940s or 50s. Wow. And Italians only agreed upon the ingredients for it in the past 30 or so years. So, you know, and in the book, I feature a dish called spaghetti all'assassina that comes out of the city of Bari, where you pan fry the pasta until it turns charred and crispy crunchy. Oh, and that dish was invented in 1960.
That's my
favorite. New version. It's really good. New versions of it are coming out today. So the point is that Italian food is actually a lot more dynamic than I think even a lot of Italians give it credit for.
Yeah.
And to me, that's very exciting.
Wow.
I want to, because you are coming to Philadelphia, mm-hmm. and we're going to tease that a little later. Sarah wants to know where you're eating in Philly. You got some good pasta spots. I can give you some recommendations, by the way, but where do you like to eat pasta in Philly? Have you been here before? Have you tried our pasta?
I love Philly. I don't know that I've eaten a ton of, I mean, I should eat pasta. I'm always, you know, I'm a big fan of all of Michael Solomonov's restaurants. I've hit up South Philly Barbacoa more than once. I'm going to be at El Chingon when I'm there in town for an event, and I'm excited to eat there.
In my neighborhood, welcome.
Philly has, I mean, phenomenal food, and I always, there's never enough time for me to eat all the food that I want to eat there. In fact, I'll tell you a quick funny Philly story is that when I was way back, but when I was in the early stages of inventing the Cascatelli pasta shop, I was talking with a guy named Emilio Minucci, who's one of the owners of DiBruno Brothers, the iconic Philly mm-hmm. Italian market. It's been there for probably over 100 years. And I said to him, you know, I'm doing this, you know, he's kind of looking at me like, who is this guy? Are you going to invent a pasta shape? I said, well, give me some advice. And he said, if it has a great story behind it, that will help to sell it and to spread it. And I was skeptical of that idea when he said it, but he turned out to be right, because the story of my 3-year process inventing the shape, I think, is a lot of what got people interested in it. So shout out to Emilio for that great advice.
Lots of great wisdom in Philadelphia.
I know.
That's a great point.
And by the way, it's getting warmer outside, and I love a good pasta salad. And you take a position that, you know, people have gone left with it, too much mayo, overcooked veggies. You argue that it's time to redeem the pasta salad. So give us some keys to a great pasta salad. And, you know, maybe I want to make one with your pasta at the Cascatelli. Maybe I want to do that one.
That's right. I mean, look, the macaroni, and I don't mind macaroni salad, but there's so much more we can do. And to me, a great pasta salad should do all the things that a great salad does. It should be bright and acidic. It should have some kind of crunch or texture to it. It should be refreshing. But, you know, so it should have those flavor notes. So, for instance, we do a raw tomato puttanesca in the cookbook. Instead of cooked tomatoes, it's raw tomatoes, olives, and then instead of traditional anchovies you would put in puttanesca, we do fish sauce. Calabrian chili is a bit of spice. There's one with cherry tomatoes and preserved lemon and toast and pan toasted gnocchi that's phenomenal. There's one with tuna and string beans. And these are all crunchy, fresh. But to me, the beauty of a pasta salad that beats a salad over greens is that you get that brightness, you get the freshness, the crunch, the acidity, the great things about a salad, but then you get that sort of baseline of carbs that just makes it feel so much more comforting and filling and satisfying. You know, sometimes you eat a delicious salad and you're like, that was delicious, but when's the meal coming? You know
exactly.
what I'm saying? And, you know, you do the same kinds of ingredients over pasta and you're going to walk away feeling spiritually satiated.
Ooh.
The carb baseline is my favorite baseline. Let me get you out. Let me get you out. This is real quick. You only got 15 seconds for this, Dan.
All right.
One pasta dish the rest of your life. Which one you're choosing?
That would be my mapo tofu cascatelli.
And I love mapo tofu. Szechuan peppercorns in there?
Oh, yeah. You know it. And Dombojang.
Yes. Thank you, Dan. That is Dan Pashman. And this Saturday, Dan will be in Philadelphia for a live taping of the Sporkful podcast in conversation with the great Kehlani Palmisano of Check Please Philadelphia. He'll be talking about his cookbook. Mm-hmm. Plus, there will be free samples of one of his pasta dishes. Tickets available at whyy.org/events. Dan Pashman, thanks for the time.
Thanks, you too.
It sounds like a delicious event.
I want to be there.
And that wraps up our show today, friends. Our producers are Debbie Builder and Andreas Copes. Diana Martinez engineered the show today from Studio 2 at WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Cherry Gregg.
And I'm Avi Wolfman Arendt. We will dine again with you tomorrow.
So much time in